from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, what might we find behind the kitchen door of the restaurants in which we dine? Discrimination, exploitation, unsanitary kitchens, and some of the poorest paid workers in America, according to Food Labor Research Center director Saru Jayaraman. In her new book, Jayaraman follows the lives of restaurant workers across the United States and explores how what takes place behind the scenes when we dine out affects the meals we eat there. She'll join us in studio for the hour ahead. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our Forum program. Fast food workers went on strike last week in 60 cities, and Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and director of the Food Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, takes us into the world of restaurant workers of all varieties in her book, Behind the Kitchen Door. The book focuses on the often largely invisible restaurant employees, the servers, bussers, cooks, and dishwashers who make up the nation's 10 million restaurant workers. That, by the way, is the country's largest workforce sector. A labor lawyer who did 12 years of restaurant organization work, Saru Jayaraman, focuses on labor practices and what lies, as the foreword title of her book suggests, behind the kitchen door. And she joins us in studio. We welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks. Well, great to have you here. And let's talk about what first may be the most shocking revelation of all, that people talk about minimum wage. They usually think about what is standard minimum wage, but for restaurant workers, it's still $2.13 an hour with tips in most places in the country. After 22 years, no change. That's it. And you've got people working late night shifts, getting no tips at all. I mean, this is really one of the more shocking elements. I heard you say on Bill Maher, we blame your good friend Herman Cain to Bill Maher, but it's true. I mean, this has been the force of the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association.
That's right. Like you said, the restaurant industry right now is the second largest, actually, and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's over 10 million workers. One in 12 Americans works in the restaurant industry, but it also happens to be the absolute lowest paying employer in the United States. So 7 of the 11 lowest paying jobs and the 2 absolute lowest paying jobs in America are restaurant jobs. And we attribute it entirely to the lobbying power of the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, which back in 1996, under the leadership of Herman Cain, who later tried to run for president on the Republican ticket, Herman Cain struck this deal as the president of the NRA with Congress, saying that they, the NRA, would not oppose an overall increase to the minimum wage as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stayed frozen forever. And so it's been stuck for the last 22 years at $2.13 an hour. Now, it is higher here in California.
California
is one of 7 states that doesn't have any difference between the minimum wage for tipped and non-tipped workers, although that is in jeopardy in some cities in the state of California right now. But it is the reason nationally and here in the state of California that restaurant servers have 3 times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce, which means the people who put food on our tables cannot afford to eat themselves. And the thing that most people don't know, and I really feel the fact that most people don't know that it's $2.13 an hour, don't know these things that are happening behind the kitchen door metaphorically, is very purposeful. The NRA has struck these deals again and again and again behind closed doors with legislators. You know,
are they the ones that gave us pizza as a vegetable?
That's right. Exactly. NRA is the same group that got Congress to declare ketchup and pizza vegetables. And they do these things without much public attention because they do not want us to know, the dining public, that they basically have said to Congress, we should not have to pay our workers' wages. The dining public should pay our workers' wages for us, because essentially they're saying these workers' wages will be paid in tips.
And although it's different in San Francisco, for example, where these workers do have paid sick leave, restaurant workers, most of the country that's just not the case. So you have people who are working with the flu and working with all kinds of whatever ailments they may have or afflictions that are communicable, and there they are in the kitchen spreading.
That's right. And you don't have to go very far. Just go across the bay to anywhere in Alameda County, Oakland, Berkeley, Richmond, you're going to find 90% of these workers nationally do not have paid sick days, which means two-thirds report cooking, preparing, and serving our food while sick. And it isn't, I want to say again, it isn't just a situation where the restaurant industry is just doing it because, you know, that's the way it is, that's the law. They are actually actively lobbying to prevent paid sick days legislation from passing anywhere in the country. In fact, the NRA has gotten together with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and Darden, the world's largest full-service restaurant company, which owns Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, and about eight other brands. They've gotten together and they've introduced legislation in 14 states to preemptively prohibit any localities in those states from passing paid sick days ordinances, and they've passed in eight states already.
Our guest is Saru Jayaraman, and she's the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. There's an introduction to your book by Eric Schlosser, who gave us Fast Food Nation and a number of other books after that, and who's been featured on this program a number of times, in fact. And I was struck by the emphasis in his talking about animal welfare and people who are concerned about the ethicality of food, why this isn't more of an issue. In other words, in fact, I think you did an interview with Amy Dean, and that I happen to hear, who's also been featured on the show a number of times. And you were talking about the fact that people are more concerned about organic chickens than they are about what goes on behind the kitchen doors. And this is a phenomenon that obviously you want to stir up with these people who are concerned about the food that they eat and the ethical nature of where that food began, who processed it, and you know what workers and laborers in terms of the food. But the restaurant has not been much of a focus here.
That's very true. And I think it's just a lack of information. You know, when Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, came out, Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, came out, you know, hundreds of thousands of people across the country got turned on to the idea of organic, locally sourced food, of the problems with our industrial food system, but very focused on the production end of things. You know, how, is it organic? Is it local? How are the animals treated? And it's funny, we put out every year, starting in 2011, a national diner's guide and smartphone app that tells you the wages, benefits, and promotion practices of the 150 most popular restaurants in America. And Mark Bittman wrote about it in the New York Times. And when he did, about 100,000 people visited our website to download the guide. And one wrote in and said, you know, I've always thought about the pigs and the cows until I read Mark's article. I never thought about the people. It seems like you're on the cusp of something really big. And to us, that was funny because we've been around for so long trying to lift up these issues. But I think the fact that people are just beginning to be educated, coming into awareness around food, although many people have been working on it for decades, a lot more people are coming into awareness around food in general, opens up the door for a lot more people to become aware around the 20 million workers in our food system, from farm workers to restaurant workers, and to take action around these issues.
Well, let's talk about action and what actions can be taken, because I know you want to really have the nation's labor laws enforced. You're going to talk to the AFL next week in Los Angeles. Minimum wage, I mean, you know, we've already covered that, the revelation of just how terrible it is and how it's been that way for over a couple of decades. So are we on toward different kinds of policies that can be indeed altering?
Absolutely. I absolutely believe that we have seen tremendous change just this year alone. I mean, the fact that fast food workers are striking, the fact that, you know, our book has gotten a lot of attention, the fact that people around the country in the food movement, you know, if you call it a movement, really have gotten very excited about the issue of workers in the food system. And there is a bill moving through Congress that actually has a chance. It's called the Fair Minimum Wage Act. It was introduced by very own George Miller from here in the Bay Area and Senator Harkin in the Senate, and it proposes to raise the overall minimum wage to $10.10. And for the first time in two decades, it proposes to raise the minimum wage for tipped workers as well at the federal level to 70% of that, meaning a 300% increase for tipped workers in America. And right here in our very own Berkeley, there's also legislation moving that would increase the overall minimum wage.
Are you talking about Assembly Bill 10, the new minimum wage law that...
No.
Oh, because I know the Restaurant Association is lobbying against that.
Yes.
That on the table.
Yes, yes. No, there is a state bill, but there is a city proposal as well to raise the minimum wage in the city of Berkeley. Now, of course, the California Restaurant Association is trying to get tipped workers left out of that minimum wage increase in the city of Berkeley. But both at the federal level and in the city of Berkeley, there's tremendous momentum now. Now that people are becoming more aware that tipped workers have been left out for so long, I think it's much more unlikely that we're going to see tipped workers being left out again and the restaurant industry getting yet another exemption for itself.
And many of these workers we're talking about are, of course, immigrants, people of color. And a lot of these jobs, I think this is another issue that needs to be raised, are being replaced by new technologies.
That's true. In fact, 70% of tipped workers in America are women. And when you, I think in the Bay Area, sometimes when people think of a tipped worker, maybe you think of a server at a fancy steakhouse or a fancy fine dining restaurant here in the city of San Francisco, when in fact, 70% of these workers are women. They work at Applebee's and IHOP and the Olive Garden and Red Lobster. Like I said, they have three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. They use food stamps, which means that the industry is getting tremendous subsidy, not just from our tips, but also from public dollars, from taxpayer dollars. And, you know, yes, there are increasingly people of color, increasingly immigrants. We see large numbers of people being laid off from other sectors coming into this industry. But I do want to say, you know, there's been a lot of talk with these fast food worker strikes. Oh, it seems like, you know, before the industry was all young people and now it's increasingly older people. And I really want to correct that myth. These were always adult workers. These were always majority adult workers. 60% of these workers are over the age 24. The median age is in the mid-30s. A good quarter have children. Many are single parents. We're talking about families supporting themselves on these incomes. And we're talking about the fact that many of them consider themselves to be professionals. They're not looking to move on to something better. You know, they're not doing this as a way to get through college. And that's not the majority of the industry. The majority of the industry are working adults who consider themselves professionals and want to stay in the industry and be treated as the professionals that they are.
Our guest again is Sarah Jayaraman. Her book is Behind the Kitchen Door. There are a lot of good owners out there, though, that are treating workers fairly. We should really mention that.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up. We've got about 100 restaurant owners across the country. They range from celebrity chefs like Tom Colicchio, star of Top Chef, who right here in the Bay Area owns many of the craft restaurants and around the country, all the way down to small mom-and-pop restaurants that are doing the right thing, providing good wages and good working conditions that really try to promote their workers from within. And they, with us, have formed a national alternative restaurant association called RAISE, Restaurants Advancing Industry Standards and Employment. Now, RAISE has come with us to Congress to say we're restaurant owners, but we actually believe in an increase to the minimum wage and the tip minimum wage. We believe in paid sick days because we've seen that it actually reduces employee turnover, increases productivity, and increases profitability in the long run.
Well, talk about that because there could be a good deal of skepticism when you say if you have a minimum wage, you raise the minimum wage, nevertheless, you'll have the same profits. Some would look at that with utter skepticism. I mean, how does that equate?
Yes.
Know? But it's been proven by
it's
you how?
It's been proven to be true. So first of all, we've got, like I said, about 100 employers who have comparable prices to other employers who pay not just livable, but many of them pay what we call thrivable wages. They've managed to work it into their business plan, create efficiencies in other areas of their business so that they actually are able to pay their workers a livable wage, provide the same prices as everybody else, and make a hefty profit. So hefty, in fact, that these companies are growing. So one example, you know, in the city of Detroit, we've got a partner, the Russell Street Deli, that opened right at the height of the recession and actually has managed to grow about 300% over the last several years, has over 50 employees, and actually pays each of them a thrivable wage, $10 and up plus tips. You know, they're doing very, very well because they themselves were restaurant workers, wanted to pay their workers well, treat their workers well, and are doing very well. Customers are supporting them because they see that they're treating their workers well. Now, I want to say on the other end, the argument is, oh, well, you know, either jobs are going to be lost or consumer prices are going to go up. So the thing that's so funny is that California is the perfect example. San Francisco is the perfect example for why empirically it's just not true that jobs are lost when the minimum wage goes up. Right now, San Francisco has the highest minimum wage for all workers, including restaurant workers, in the country. And the restaurant industry in the city of San Francisco is thriving. California is one of the 7 states in the United States that does not have a different minimum wage for tipped and non-tipped workers, has the largest restaurant industry in the country.
Of course, California, it's thriving in great part because of the tech boom and because of the economy that is invested in the restaurant.
Absolutely. But the wage that's high has not hindered that growth in any way whatsoever. In fact, California's restaurant industry is doing great, is growing more fat quicker, actually, than the industry growth rate for the rest of the country.
So quick that there are areas of San Francisco where they have, like a Valencia Street, where they have to be worried about the quota of the number of restaurants that they have.
That's right.
But you also take into account the discrimination on the basis of gender and race that is rampant in different parts of the country, in different restaurant chains and different restaurants and so forth. And what can be done about this in terms of legislation or policy?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, right now there's a $4 wage gap between white workers and workers of color in our industry. Workers of color are concentrated not just in lower level positions, so bussers, runners, what we call the back of the house, the kitchen, dishwashers, but they're also concentrated in lower level segments, in fast food, in casual restaurants like the Red Lobster, as opposed to fine dining. You walk into any fine dining restaurant, or most in San Francisco, you're going to see a very segregated, racially segregated, workforce, who's serving you versus who's busing and who's in the back of the house. Policy really needs to look at both incentivizing and penalizing employers for out-and-out racial discrimination, and incentivizing employers who promote from within, who really provide training opportunities for their workers to move up the ladder. So, for example, we've got a national training program where we train low-wage workers of color to move up the ladder from fast food into fine dining server and bartending positions, to move from a busser or runner position to fine dining server positions. And states and localities around the country have supported that training program because they see that actually not only are workers of color allowed to move up the ladder, you diversify your workforce, you actually end up with better customer service when workers have to go through a formal training to learn how to be a fine dining server. So you see more loyalty, you see less turnover. I mean, it's a win-win for everybody.
We're talking again, if you've just joined us, with Sarah Jayaraman, and her book is called Behind the Kitchen Door. I'm going to open up our phone lines and get responses from you, our listeners. A couple questions. How visible are the people who work in restaurants to you, and the labor conditions and questions that have to do with sanitary conditions and the like, which we've touched on here, but also those of you who work in this industry and those of you who are servers or in some form or another actually part of the restaurant working world, or if you own a restaurant, I'd like to hear your thoughts and have you reflect and raise any concerns that you have. Questions and comments in general, of course, welcome, or reactions to what you've heard so far. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program. Again, toll-free, you can do it now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talk just a bit about, Sarah, if you could, about how this all began. It kind of, with you, it all started after 9/11.
That's right. On September 11th, there was a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, called Windows on the World in New York City. And on that morning of 9/11, 73 workers died and about 13,000 restaurant workers lost their jobs in the months and weeks following the tragedy. So there was a very tiny union inside that restaurant because less than 0.001% of all restaurant workers in the United States are unionized. So the tiny restaurant, a tiny union that was inside that restaurant was not able to provide support, or, you know, it didn't have the resources to provide ongoing support to the workers who had lost their jobs. So they asked me and one of the head waiters, actually, from Windows on the World, an immigrant from Morocco named Fekak Mamdou. Mamdou and I got together, founded ROC in the aftermath of the tragedy.
ROC is an acronym for?
For the Restaurant Opportunity Center. And our website is rocunited.org. And since that time, since 9/11 until now, we've grown into a national restaurant workers organization. We now have 10,000 restaurant worker members in 32 cities across the country. We have about 100 employer partners that have formed this alternative national restaurant association. And we have several thousand consumer members. We are open to consumers getting involved, getting active, and supporting these workers. And so we've grown really rapidly. And it's been entirely due to demand. Demand from workers saying, we really need you, come to our city. Demand from employers saying, you know, work with us. We want to treat our workers well. Work with us. And demand from consumers saying, how can we be part of this movement?
Well, it's a real success story in many respects.
Thanks.
And, you know, there are a lot of jokes made about nobody would like to see the way legislation is made, you know, if they were looking at Congress in terms of just the process. But the same might be said about what's behind the kitchen door in terms of restaurants. When you got 90%, isn't that right? 90%
yeah.
No sick day.
That's right.
Leaves.
That's right. So two-thirds of these workers are working without, you know, two-thirds are saying they're working while sick. And it's sick means, you know, in my book, there are stories of workers working with H1N1, better known as swine flu. There are stories of workers working with hepatitis, working with typhoid fever. you know, we have a campaign right now against Darden, the world's largest full-service restaurant company that owns Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, and about 8 other brands. Back in 2011, Darden announced a partnership with Michelle Obama and her Let's Move campaign, saying that they were going to provide healthy food for kids at the Olive Garden. At the same moment of that announcement, a server in a Fayetteville, North Carolina Olive Garden had to work with hepatitis A because they didn't have paid sick days. 3,000 people had to get tested for hepatitis A, filed a consumer class action against the restaurant, and won. And that same year, there were 2 stomach flu outbreaks in an Indiana and an Illinois Olive Garden. I mean, how healthy can the food be for your kids if the workers are working with stomach flu or hepatitis? These are the kinds of things we're exposed to every day when these workers don't have paid sick days.
Let me start with our callers in Carolina. You're first up here. Good morning. Carolina, excuse me.
Yeah, good morning. I was listening to the show, and it really brought me back to my years as a server. I worked as a server in New York City for many years, all throughout college, and a particular experience was in an Italian restaurant where I was not allowed to work the night shift. I was only given the lunch shift, which was not as busy, and it was an Italian restaurant, and all the servers on the night shift were of European descent. And I can even argue that I was a better server than most of them. But I'm Hispanic, so I didn't have the right
look.
I guess look that they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And there was also a Mexican boss boy who had been there for years. And we will have these conversations that he was never going to be given the opportunity to be a server, regardless of the fact that he knew the restaurant in and out, because he wasn't white. And so I know it happens not just in San Francisco, but all over New York City. You can go to any restaurant, go to the kitchen, and I don't care how many stars the restaurant is, you will see a large number of usually Hispanic cooks, but they are not represented on the floor.
Yeah, I'm afraid one sees this to this day. I mean, you know, when I go back home, I come from Cleveland, Ohio. There are certain restaurants where all of the busing and all of the tray picking up and so forth is done by African Americans, whereas the waiters and waitresses are all Caucasian.
And the industry likes to argue, well, this is because, quote unquote, they can't speak the language, or they don't have what's called table talk. So we tested this. We sent 200 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants in New York City, with the people of color having a better resume, more qualified. We found that the white applicants had twice the chance of a person of color of getting one of these fine dining server or bartending jobs. And then we said, you know, a reporter said to me, well, isn't it just that they can't speak English, or they're quote unquote illegal? That's why they can't become servers. So we tested that. We gave the white workers a very strong European accent. We gave the workers of color a mild person of color accent and a non-European accent. We found that for the white workers, having any kind of accent was a bonus in getting one of these jobs. And for the workers of color, it was always a detractor. So it's not skills, it's not experience, it's not language, it is purely race and skin color. And table talk is often this proxy for skin color.
Talking about restaurants with Saru Jayaraman, and her book again is Behind the Kitchen Door. By the way, the restaurant industry is the fastest growing employer in the United States, second biggest employer. And again, we're going to hear from some restaurant owners as well as people who have worked in restaurants and what your concerns are as a diner out in restaurants. We certainly welcome your calls and emails. And you can also post anything you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle at KQED Forum. We'll return hearing more from you when we do return. And again, Saru Jayaraman is also co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, what do you think you might be likely to find in the kitchens of restaurants where you dine? Well, discrimination, exploitation, unsanitary kitchens, some of the more poor workers in America, according to Food Labor Research Center Director Saru Jayaraman. And in her new book, she follows the lives of restaurant workers across the United States and explores how what takes place behind the scenes when we dine out affects the meals we eat there. And she's with us in studio for this hour, and you are welcome to join the conversation. I want to have a caller join us who is a restaurant owner. Robert, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good afternoon or good morning. My name is Robert. I own a Japanese restaurant in Michigan called Ken Ken Ramen. Fully in support of what the labor activist is saying, I'm a first-time restaurant owner, and it's not hard to make a profitable restaurant and still pay a living wage. I mean, I'm offended by, you know, giant corporate chains that, you know, spend so much on retail expansion, advertising and things like that, and still pay nothing. It's offensive to me.
Well, I thank you for expressing that. And in fact, when we're talking about profit, there's a lot of research done by our guest. Walmart, compared to the restaurant industry, 4 to 5 times more profit margin in the restaurant industry across the board.
That's right. Walmart, which is generally known as the most profitable, one of the most profitable companies in the world, has a 1% profit margin. The restaurant industry nationally and in the state of California has a 4 to 5% profit margin, meaning these are high volume chains. And Robert is so right. It is primarily these chains that are running the National Restaurant Association, that are leading even the California Restaurant Association. They are the ones fighting to keep the wages as low as they are. And yet they are the ones raking in the dollar, the billions of dollars. You know, they proudly proclaim that they've won $1 billion in exemptions by keeping wages as low as they are, by making work diners pay for their workers' wages. So, Robert, I thank you so much. Everybody should be supporting your restaurant because you are the kind of owner that really, you know, says, look, you can do it. You can do it well. You can treat your workers well. You can still make a profit. It is true. There are 100 other restaurant owners like you out there who've said the same thing, who've come out and said it. There are many more out there who do it, but need to come out and say it to oppose the NRA. Yeah.
I heard his genuine sincerity and outrage. Got a good plug for his restaurant, too, though. A listener asks, do you think tips should be abolished to decrease the wage gap between servers and kitchen workers?
I actually don't think that that is the I don't think that question makes any sense to ask in our current state of affairs. In our current state of affairs, restaurant servers earn poverty wages, as I said. They have 3 times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. They rely on our tips to live, even in the state of California. And so it's actually not, to me, about whether you get rid of tips or not. It's actually about raising that wage to a stable base income so that these workers have some stability to live on, so that they don't have to wonder, am I going to make $50 tonight or $200 tomorrow? I actually know what my wage is. That's the key point.
Well, here's a curious question from Paul. It says, as has been made clear, San Francisco minimum wage laws apply to tip workers. Healthy San Francisco requires health care for them as well. Why does the restaurant industry continue the illusion that a 20-25% tip should be mandatory?
Yeah. The restaurant industry wants us to continue to tip because they want to continue to pay poverty wages. So, again, we need to push the industry to pay its own workers' wages as every other industry does.
Robert writes, another Robert, are the cash register located tip jars one sees at places like Starbucks and Subway Sandwich placed there by management in order to classify the workers there as tipped, or do these jars have no such effect or purpose?
Great question. It really depends on the company. I mean, Starbucks has been sued, actually, over the issue of tips. So, you know, really, the issue is that these are the very same companies that are fighting to keep the minimum wage as low as it is. And that's where we need to put our efforts, is fighting to raise that minimum wage.
Why was were they sued over tips? Were they keeping them? Or?
Yes, there was a fight over these kinds of tips and jars. You know, it's funny. They are up there, out there at the federal level and at the state level saying we shouldn't have to pay anymore. We'll die if we have to pay anymore. And yet, you know, all the diners should have to support our workers for us. It's just an incredible irony.
Let me bring another caller on. Valerie, join us. You're on.
Hi there. I'm 24 years old, and my family's been in the restaurant industry since 1936. They operate a banquet house and catering company, which is kind of outdated, but we're still going. And I've just noticed, you know, back when my grandfather was in the industry, he would be working so hard, and he had such a high expectation of his employees. And I just feel like in the last 20 years, I've just seen the quality of, not particularly the employees, but just the work ethic just kind of hitting the fan here, regardless of the wages or not.
I hear this from people in the restaurant business, that it's hard to get committed, and people who are humane and you know, thinking about owners largely, finding workers who are really as dedicated or committed as you could find, say, even just 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think wages have also gone way down in real terms since 1936. I mean, we've seen a tremendous decline relative to the rest of the private sector in this industry in terms of wages and benefits. And so, you know, you could say, oh, everybody's just becoming lazier, or you could look at what people are living on and whether they're motivated to actually contribute to an industry that exploits them as they do. Now, let me give you the flip side of this. We provide free training for workers to move up the ladder to fine dining, server, and bartending positions. And we don't have enough capacity to serve all of the workers who flood our doors seeking this training. Fast food workers, casual restaurant workers, everybody wants to be trained to move up the ladder, to better their skills, to better their situation. I mean, we'll post an ad for free training and within 8 hours we'll get 300 responses in a major location like the Bay Area. And so, you know, the truth is that we have found among the thousands and thousands of workers we're talking to, people want to stay. People want to move up the ladder. People want better skills. But they actually, in our industry, there's a 300% turnover rate. And it's not statistically because workers are moving from this into acting, or, you know, there may be some workers who are doing that. But the vast majority of these workers want to stay in this industry and, like I said, be treated as the professionals that they are. So they're moving from restaurant to restaurant, not out of the industry, but from restaurant to restaurant, seeking better wages, better ways to support their family. I think the best evidence that you actually can have a good work ethic treating your workers well is the fact that our employers across the country, our partners around the country, these 100 employers, actually have almost a zero turnover rate compared to the 300% turnover rate you see in the rest of the industry. These workers want to stay.
Well, when you talk about this industry and exploitation and turnover, I mean, one can't mistake the importance of, and you give many examples of, sexual discrimination, gender discrimination. I mean, it's rampant, it's rife in sexual harassment in every industry probably, but in this industry, maybe behind the kitchen door more so.
Yes, that's right. In the book, I tell a story of Nikki Lewis, who was a member of ours and then became an organizer and a director in Washington, D.C., faced such severe sexual harassment at the restaurant as a young woman, her first job out of college. Such severe sexual harassment that the environment led to her actually being assaulted sexually by a coworker. And I can't tell you how common this story is. In fact, when Herman Cain's, you know, when the charges came out against Herman Cain when he was running for president, MSNBC reported that while 7% of American women work in the restaurant industry, 37% of all charges of sexual harassment to the EEOC come from the restaurant industry. I mean, this is an industry very ripe with sexual harassment. And one thing that I want our listener, you know, your listeners to know is, and to think about, for every one of us that has a daughter, most young women in America, this is the first job they experience. Whether or not they're going to move on to something else, most young women during high school or college or graduate school, they work in this industry and they are exposed to an environment in which they're treated with complete disrespect. And I can't tell you the number of women who've come up to me when I've spoken in, around the country and said, you know, I work as an executive at IBM or I'm a corporate lawyer and I've been sexually harassed, but I never did anything about it because it was never as bad as it was when I was in restaurants in college. And so basically young women are exposed to this idea that they can be touched and treated to in any which way, and that's okay, and that lasts a lifetime.
We go to more of your calls. Let's welcome, is it Jai?
Yes, Jai.
Yeah. Hi, you're on the air.
I think that what with the idea of having this temporary type of workmanship and volatility, that there is an issue that I've seen because I've worked at a couple of very large, well-known chains in San Francisco and in New York, is that we've seen issues where that the menu says that they're serving a certain kind of fish or a certain kind of meat or a certain kind of wine, and they're not. And we can't really say anything about it because it was, we didn't want to lose our shift or lose our job. Because they can replace it with 20 or 30 other people. And so by being able to not say that there's sexual harassment or that there's a health issue or that there's a fraud essentially going on because the menu's saying one thing and charging $30 for a product that something is actually of low quality, if not even healthy.
Certainly put servers in a terrible position, what he's described here, and not uncommon again, Sarah?
Absolutely. And I think you've got to, again, remember that these workers are reliant on customers' tips to live. So when you're living on the largesse of people who are coming to the restaurant, you're not going to tell them, well, actually, your strawberries are not really organic or something's happening in the kitchen. You are reliant on these customers' tips. You're living on the largesse of people. I mean, this also means you are going to come in when you're sick regardless, because you need to live on those tips. You're going to put up with whatever the customers do to you, whether they pinch your bottom or slap you. I mean, that is, you know, that's part of the industry. So again, it all comes back to the fact that the industry has set up a situation where the workers are completely at the mercy, not only of their employer, but also of the very customers that they're serving.
And let me thank the caller. Here's a listener who writes, I enjoy watching the TV series Kitchen Nightmares, which shows the worst of the worst, but based on what I've experienced and heard about over the years, I suspect food, cleanliness, and labor standards are low in a large percentage of restaurants. And yet, in my experience, filing a complaint with health inspectors is often futile. Inspectors are lazy and tend to side with businesses.
Well, thanks for the comment. I mean, we actually did a study over the last many years. We've actually correlated our data where we've correlated surveys coming in from restaurant workers about illegal labor practices and unhealthy conditions. We actually asked workers, are you forced to do things by the employer that are unsanitary? And we found a direct correlation between restaurants that are, you know, engaged in very illegal or exploitative labor practices and those that are doing unsanitary, unhealthy things to their customers. And so that's why consumers really need to understand that it doesn't matter how locally sourced, how organic, how healthy the food might be, or as the caller said, might claim to be, if the workers are not treated well, paid well, don't have paid sick days, where if employment laws are being violated, it is going to directly impact your food on your plate, your dining experience. And so consumers need to take action. Unfortunately, there actually are ways consumers can take action.
Well, I guess, Lisa, you want to know how consumers can take action. Lisa from Santa Rosa, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for this program.
You're welcome.
I applaud your efforts. This is a great thing. And so my question is, I've just gone online and looked at the Diner's Guide, and thank you for compiling that information. But how may I, as a consumer, and we do like to eat out, how can I do a little bit of research before going into a restaurant and say, you know, hey, do you provide these incentives or get the same type of information that you put in your guide? How can I ask that from the restaurants you go to?
It's a really great question. Thank you, Lisa. There's actually three things that we like to ask every consumer in America to do to support this movement. The first is to get the book and share it with others, get other people to read the book, because there's so much happening behind the kitchen door, which is the title of the book, that people don't know about, really need to know about. The more educated we are, the better we can be in supporting this movement and supporting these workers. The second thing is that there is a website where people can go to sign a petition and join about 100,000 other people that want to tell the Restaurant Association and Congress, you should be listening to us. We should not have to pay your workers' wages for you. Raise the wage. So it's called thewelcometable.net, and you can sign a petition there to raise the minimum wage to support the Fair Minimum Wage Act. The third thing is exactly what you're talking about. How can we actually communicate our values to restaurants and let them know that we care about these issues and that we need to see change? And this is so key, because 10 years ago, I remember just having started out with organizing this industry, I remember 10 years ago, restaurants saying, we'll never be able to provide, this was in New York, restaurants saying, we'll never be able to provide locally sourced organic cuisine. It's just too expensive. There's no way. And now 10 years later, restaurants jumping over themselves to at least claim that they're providing locally sourced organic healthy cuisine. And so I think that all came about due to consumer demand. Consumers reading books, watching movies, and demanding. These are values that are important to me. And that's why we created the guide. We want people to use the guide not to find out where to eat or where not to eat. The truth is, I think, like Michael said, the vast majority of restaurants in America are following a standard set by the National Restaurant Association, and so may or may not be providing livable wages and good working conditions. So the best thing that I think consumers can do, because it is very difficult to actually find out from just asking, you never know what the truth is, the best thing that we can do is actually at the end of your meal, go up to the manager or the owner, not your server, and say to the manager or the owner, I love the food, I love the service, I want to let you know as a diner, it is really important to me what's in this guide, and show them the smartphone app. It's really, my values as a paying customer are that I want to see workers paid well and treated well, provided paid sick days because my health is at stake and my family's health is at stake, and promoted from within because I don't believe in segregation or discrimination.
And the availability of the guide, easiest way to get it?
You can get it on your smartphone. It's just the ROC National Diners Guide, or at our website, rockunited.org.
And I thank the caller. Here's Jim, who says, if I want a Big Mac, I don't go to Burger King. I go to McDonald's because they sell Big Macs. If one wants a good paying job, why would one get a job at a place that does not pay well? Lack of skills, irresponsible life choices, such as having children when not in a position to adequately support them, etc. I fail to see why the restaurant owner should be penalized for other people's choices. If it wasn't for restaurant owners providing these jobs, what else would these unskilled workers do to support themselves?
So thanks for the comment. The truth is that a large number of these workers are skilled, are educated. Almost half have some college education. Right now, these are the jobs that are out there. So the restaurant industry is the second largest employer in the United States. It's proliferating the lowest paying jobs, workers being laid off from other sectors, even finance. We've seen workers laid off from financial management jobs going into the restaurant industry. These are the jobs that are out there for young people, for any new entrants into the economy. And believe it or not, there are people who actually love food service, take great pride in hospitality, in serving others, in the business of running a restaurant, being part of a restaurant. People actually love it. They should be treated as the professionals that they are, as the skilled workers that they are. Because I don't know if the caller ever or the writer ever actually worked in a restaurant, but it takes tremendous skill to actually cook food, serve food, create a dining environment that works for consumers. Now, on the question of...
He's talking about fast food specifically.
Well, even in fast food, people, you know, we know members who've stayed in the industry for generations working in fast food that actually enjoy it, want to stay, want to be treated well, want to be paid well. And again, they're adults, they're not kids. You know, all kinds of people make all kinds of life choices and need to be paid a livable wage to support themselves and their families. These are people, after all, touching our food. Now, even at the, let's take McDonald's as an example. We did a study, I did a study together with colleagues at UC Davis, a professor named Chris Benner at UC Davis. We used USDA methodology to look at if the minimum wage were to go up as predicted in Congress, you know, as proposed in Congress, $10.10, and that were true for all workers up the food chain, from farm workers all the way up to fast food workers, how much would that increase the cost of your Big Mac? And we found that even if employers passed on 100% of that price increase to consumers, which they never do, but if they did, the total increase in food costs for all food bought outside the home, both in grocery stores and restaurants, would be 10 cents a day. The title of the report is A Dime a Day. Pennies on your Big Mac, pennies on your groceries.
Report online? Can they people
yes,
find it?
At the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley.
And there is a link to the Restaurant Opportunity Center's guide on our website, by the way,
great,
kqed.org. And bring on another caller. Chris, that's you. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, well, I'm old and I grew up in the Bay Area, but when I was younger, I would not eat at a place that was not a union house. And you could find a little neighborhood hamburger place that was a union house. My local ice cream place used to be a union house. And now that doesn't exist anymore except in the fanciest restaurants.
So very true. Here in the Bay Area, there was a significant history of unionization in the restaurant industry, thanks to Unite Here Local 2 here in San Francisco, which, you know, really did amazing work. The Restaurant Association, again, is responsible for breaking that history, for breaking the union, for getting rid of unions in restaurants. And the, you know, just as the industry exploded over the last couple of decades, the unionization rate declined precipitously. And so now you've got, like I said, nationally, less than 0.001% of all restaurant workers in the U.S.
Well, dovetailing with that, yeah. David writes, this is a problem inherent in our American system. If people will take these jobs for $2 plus tips an hour. That wage will persist. If people still patronize these restaurants, the wages will persist. Capitalism is about profit and doesn't care about a living wage, no matter what the industry. We need more labor organizing. A listener writes, what about the French system where the tip or gratuity is included in the bill? This not only makes it fairer for the server, but takes the politics out of deciding on a server tip. And by the way, it's not only France, it's throughout Europe, of course.
Yes. I mean, the thing that we would look at the European system, again, I'm not going to comment on getting rid of tips or including them in the bill. I think the key thing is providing people a stable base income. That's what it's really about, not people not having to rely on the tips to live.
But, you know, there's been an ongoing perennial debate about what is a living wage.
Yes.
And a living wage may be very different in San Francisco than it is in Peoria.
That's right. And it definitely has to be higher in places where the cost of living is higher. But I think, you know, we come back to the fast food workers. They're asking for $15, which may seem high until you know that actually that would have been our minimum wage if it had continued to rise with inflation. But the Restaurant Association, again, has been the primary advocate on the Hill. There's not even another employer association as loud and vocal as the Restaurant Association saying, no, it should not rise with inflation. It should be artificially deflated. And in fact, the tipped workers' wage should be stuck forever.
That's why it's called the second NRA, because
that's right.
The impact and influence has had. Let me get another caller on. Mordechai, good morning.
Hi. My question is this. How do you keep the prices the same and pay the workers more?
Yeah, it's a great question. Our employer partners around the country have managed to create business plans that allow them to create efficient. They start with the notion that I want to invest in these workers' wages. I want to have a stable, loyal, productive workforce. So I'm going to start with by creating a business plan that takes into account high workers' wages, or at least livable workers' wages, and create efficiencies in other areas of their business. And they've managed to make it work. In fact, like I said, we've got about any number of growing businesses around the country that are able to do this. And then with our study, if your question was to the study we did, what we found when we raised, you know, we did this USDA methodology, we applied the increase to workers throughout the food system and found a 10-cent increase at the end for consumers. And the reason was that workers' wages are so low in the food system and in the restaurant industry, I mean, $2, right? That it was such a small part of the overall cost of running the business for all of the business throughout the food system that they managed to actually, you know, if they passed on 100% of the cost increase, it did not increase consumer prices that much.
Let me thank the caller and go to an email here from a listener named Jeff who writes, I worked in restaurants for many years and wanted to mention some points the guest has not brought up about restaurant workers. One, working in a kitchen is a hot, physical, stressful environment. This leads to a lot of drug use, stimulants, and alcohol especially. Two, the kitchen is a place for a lot of workplace injuries, cuts, burns, caustic chemical burns, and workers are pressured to not get these treated because they would be reported to workers' comp. And three, there is tacit acceptance that most tips are unreported income. This affects national tax revenue, so this amounts to a further tax subsidy of the restaurant sector, which really rolls up to the owners, not the workers, though the workers benefit to the extent that they are not caught.
So I appreciate the comments. And absolutely, the restaurant industry is one of the top three, I believe, sources of workplace injuries and health and safety issues. And again, without paid sick days, workers are asked to stay with a cut finger. I mean, I can tell you horrible stories, but one of the worst that I remember is a worker who sliced off a finger with a, you know, meat slicer, was asked to keep working as the blood, you know, poured out everywhere. They just basically taped up the finger, and a woman actually ended up biting into the finger in her salad. And this, you know, it sounds horrible and disgusting, and people haven't eaten lunch yet, but it happens much more frequently than people realize. It's a high-pressure environment, and the incentive when workers don't have paid sick days is to stay and continue to work. Otherwise, they are often told they will be fired.
It happens. You don't mean fingers necessarily.
No, but all kinds of injuries, burnt skin falling into food. of course, sick workers sneezing on the food or having hepatitis or typhoid fever, not because they want to be there sick, but because they're told that they'd be fired if they don't. And if they're living off tips, they don't have a choice but to go to work to get their income.
There's also these stories, not necessarily apocryphal, about you know, servers and kitchen workers being angry at a customer who's perhaps demanding or insistent and actually spitting in food when they're sick or they're not sick.
Yeah, I think you'd find find a lot less of that if it's true. I think you'd find a lot less of that if workers felt like they were treated with dignity and respect. Because so let me give you an example of a restaurant that we work very closely with in actually Michigan, which is generally considered to be a very depressed state, again. But one of the most successful restaurant owners in America is a man named Paul Saginaw, who owns the Zingerman's Restaurant Company in Ann Arbor. They own about 8 restaurants, have 600 employees.
Boy, have you hit a place there. I mean, I actually get stuff from Zingerman's in the mail.
Exactly. I mean, they are one of the best paying employers in America. They pay they don't even call it a livable wage. They pay a thrivable wage, paid sick days, wonderful health care. They have zero employee turnover. And not only that, they involve their workers in what's called open book management. They actually show the workers the budget. They let the workers set prices. They train their workers in how are we going to make a profit. And when they make a profit, the workers see bonuses.
They also have some of the best deli food anywhere.
Anywhere,
and you can
that's
get
right.
it through the mail. I'm giving them a plug because I've enjoyed
really
their food
well
very
for
much
themselves.
Through the
years. And why? Because workers are involved and invested in the success of the business. If you're not involved or invested, you don't care. You know, you may end up doing things that harm the health and safety of the customer because nobody cares about you and you feel completely disempowered to provide a great service to your customers.
Let me get it. Andrea, hi.
I've heard that In-N-Out Burger is a very righteous organization. They certainly are successful, and they pay their workers well. And I've heard that they give them health care and all sorts of things. So it is possible to run a fast food restaurant and be righteous, too, I think.
And Tom Keller of the French Laundry actually said on this program that he eats the burgers at In-N-Out. They're also known as an enlightened operation.
Yeah. Absolutely. They are one of the 70 companies that got an award in our guide for their livable wages and great working conditions. And they absolutely prove, you're right, that you can run even a fast food, a burger company, and provide livable wages and working conditions.
French fries at McDonald's are still better, though. Anyway, that's my strongest editorial comment of the day. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And good luck and ongoing success. Behind the Kitchen Door, Saru J.R. Rahman is the author, forward by Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you can continue this conversation online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks and Chad McClymans. And executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you again for being a part of this morning's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.